Archiving data is one of the most important parts of any space mission. This is Western Worlds. Greetings and welcome to another episode of Western Worlds. I'm John Kissy, speaking to you from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Collecting the data from a space instrument is only the beginning stage in having an item usable in scientific inquiry. That data will be collected and sent back to Earth as a stream of binary data to be reconstructed, calibrated, and then converted to something human-readable. That last stage has many of its own complexities, especially when it comes to providing datasets usable to scientists all over the world. Because of this, data archiving is one of the most important aspects of any space mission. This week we talked to David Heather, planetary archive scientist at European Space Agency, about his career and some of the nuances and difficulties involved in the organisation and storage of scientific data. Let's go to that interview.
It's a pleasure to speak to you, first of all. I'd like to thank you for taking the time to speak to Western Worlds. You've had a very interesting career at ESA and in science in general, so let's start off at the beginning. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, it's a little bit of luck more than judgment on my part. I started off with my undergraduate degree. I actually applied to the University of Hertfordshire to study a combination of geology and chemistry with the idea to go into geochemistry and look for oil and all sorts of exciting things and make lots of money. And just at the take-up point, I bumped into the astronomy professor in the corridor and spent about 2 or 3 hours talking to him and waxing lyrical about amazing stuff about stars and planets and all sorts of things. And he convinced me to try out for astronomy and drop the chemistry because the chemistry teacher was quite boring. So I thought on a whim, let's give it a go. Let's see what happens. I went to the first astronomy lecture and I was sold straight away. Ever since I was a kid, I was always fascinated by astronomy and the stars, but I never actually thought I could get into that field. I never studied pure physics. I never studied pure mathematics. I always sort of knew bits and pieces about it, but did more generalized studies. So I sort of fell into it, and my undergraduate degree ended up being a combination of astronomy with some geology. I graduated from the University of Hertfordshire in 1995 and then went directly on to a PhD at University College London, where I was looking at data from the Clementine mission, which went to the moon in the early 90s. It was an American mission, went to the moon in the early 90s. And I was looking at the history of volcanism on the moon and some impact craters on the moon, looking at how they formed, the history of the stratigraphy on the lunar surface, and how these impact craters form, how the volcanoes form, those things. I spent 5 years at University College London studying that, finished my PhD in the year 2000. And 2 days after I defended my PhD, I took up duty at ESA, working first of all on the Smart One mission, which went to the moon in the early 2000s as well, because they needed a lunar expert on site and they didn't have one here in ESTEC. So I moved to ESTEC in 2000 and spent a couple of years working as a research fellow doing science on the moon, carrying on the work that I was doing from my PhD, and then from there moved on to my proper career within ESA.
You said you'd always had an interest in astronomy, but you were set on going down the geological route.
To me, the studies that I did at school were more towards the geology side than the astronomy side, primarily because I'm not a natural mathematician, and I always had it in my head that in order to do astronomy, in order to understand astronomy and astrophysics and those things, you really do need that background in physics and pure mathematics, which I simply don't have a natural talent for. So instead I followed the other side of the passion, which was geology, and really it was serendipitous that I bumped into this guy in the corridor and he sold the astronomy course to me. And there is of course a direct link between astronomy and geology, because you can start to look at the geology of the other planets and do comparative planetology, which is just like a dream come true for me. So I went down that path straight away, and those were the aspects of the astronomy course which I was really most passionate about. I was very, very lucky that I fell on my feet and really went down that path in the long run.
Now, I mean, you said you came out of your PhD, you did a postdoctoral fellowship here at ESA.
I mean, I came here after my PhD, and when you do a PhD, you're focusing very specifically on certain problems. You're trying to, you know, really come to a better understanding of some very specific problems within whatever field you're doing a PhD on. And then when I came to ESA, the Smart One was about to fly. It was primarily a technology testing mission, so we were trying to test technologies that were going to be used on future planetary exploration missions and future astronomy exploration missions as well. So there was a whole aspect of technological information that I really hadn't dealt with before. I'd learned specifically how the instruments that I was using in my PhD, I'd learned specifically how those work, and specifically how to deal with the data that comes back from them and calibrate that data, how to understand the gory details of that data. And now we have a whole suite of new data and a whole suite of new instruments which are working in a completely different way. Because, as I say, we're trying to miniaturize, we're trying to advance technologically how things are going to work on a spacecraft, both in terms of scientific operations, but also in terms of communication, of transit as well. With Smart One, we were actually using an ion propulsion engine, which meant it took an absolute age to get to the moon, but it was testing this new way of actually moving very, very slowly. It took 17 months, I think, to get to the moon. But it was testing a technology whereby we would just move along with a very slow impulse, a very small impulse, using ion thrusters, which were going to be used for Baby Columbo in the long run, their mission to Mercury in the long run. So there was a big transition for me. I started as a research fellow for the first 2 years, but I wasn't just doing pure science in that time. I was learning all about technology. I was learning all about how ESA programs work as well, which was invaluable for me. How ESA actually go through the selection process for instrumentation, how they run through reviews of technology testing, of making sure that things are flight ready, that everything is tested to the extent where it's ready to go into space and it's ready to actually go to the moon and perform. So you can't simply just stick a camera on a spacecraft and let it fly. There's all sorts of things that have to go before you get to that stage. And I think that's fairly obvious. You have an understanding of, a basic understanding of that. But there's so much that goes into it that I was not aware of until I started work on the Smart One mission. So it was a big transition, especially on the technological side and on the programmatics side of understanding how ESA works with the delegations as well, because each of the instruments was, of course, being provided by a different country from a different delegation. And there was an awful lot of iterations with the high-level council in order to get these things working, get these things funded and get these things on the spacecraft in time, in flight, and then delivering science. As a technology tester, Smart One was not primed for science. It was primed to make sure that if you say take an image, it takes an image. It was a technology tester. It wasn't about taking an image that was scientifically useful. So we had a lot of extra work to do there as well in order to make sure that what was taken would be useful in the long run. So there was a big transition, yeah.
All the instruments, every part of that spacecraft was a demonstration. And being a scientist, what was it like on a mission like that? How was that necessarily compared with missions you've been involved with afterwards? And then secondly, managing this project with stakeholders from different countries, from different cultures. I mean, what was that like for you, especially coming straight out of university?
Yeah, for me, it was intimidating and exciting at the same time. And I tried to focus more on the exciting rather than the intimidating. But that's a bit tricky. I mean, I was quite lucky to land at ESA, really. I bumped into the project scientist of Smart One, Bernard Huang. I bumped into him at a science meeting and just got talking to him about the work that I was doing. And he told me that there was a lunar program, a mission called Smart One that was going to the moon. And basically, we just got together and had dinner together. And that was the beginning of how I ended up at ESA, because he suggested that I would apply for a research fellowship specifically to look at this data, to help him out on the scientific side. And from there on, that's basically how I started here at ESA. In terms of working with the technology side, when I first arrived, it was very intimidating. I was thrown in very much at the deep end, sitting in what we call CDRs, critical design reviews for some of the instruments, and I had very little understanding of what was happening in those meetings at that stage. Mm-hmm. So it was learning a few phrases here and there, learning a little bit about how the programs were working bit by bit. And it was at least 6 months or so before I really had an understanding of the full instrument suite, of the status of the instruments as they were at that time before launch, and what really programmatically would need to be done in order to make sure that the instruments could get on the spacecraft and fly and deliver some science. Now, of course, I wasn't responsible for this at the end of the day. I was simply a research fellow who would be doing some science with the data that came down and trying to make sure that the data that came down would be scientifically useful. So for me, it was simply I was an observer, and I was learning and trying to absorb as much information as possible. It was absolutely fascinating and really scary at the same time, because, as I said a few minutes ago, you have no idea what people have to go through in order to get an instrument on a spacecraft, in order to get that spacecraft ready for flight, in order to fly that spacecraft and then go through the whole operational procedure, get the data back down on the ground, and then, you know, make it useful, which is basically my job now, trying to make sure that data that comes down from a spacecraft is useful to an end scientist. I mean, there's hundreds of people involved in that process, and there's thousands and thousands of man hours involved in that process, man years involved in that process. It's a huge effort, even for a small mission like Smart One. It was an exciting program, very short, but a very exciting program to be involved in.
I first met you when you were Planetary Science Archive Coordinator. So maybe you could explain a little bit about what that role entails.
So after I finished on Smart One, I actually joined what at that time was a very embryonic team for the Planetary Science Archive. The Planetary Science Archive is ESA's central repository for all science data from our planetary missions. And when I first joined, there was no planetary data from any mission from ESA. The only planetary or solar system mission, let's say, that was flown by ESA was the Giotto mission in 1986. And all of that data was stored in America with the planetary data system, with NASA's PDS, as it's called. And ESA did not have a store of that data. But we were flying Mars Express, or about to launch Mars Express, and we had a drive to try and create an area or a repository where we could store all of our science data and serve all of our science data to the community for that mission and for the upcoming missions of Rosetta and Venus Express as well. And Smart One fell under that umbrella to a certain extent. It was, as I said, a smaller mission, technology driven. So the 2 years that I spent as a research fellow working on Smart One, I was also helping the embryonic Planetary Science Archive to prepare some sort of draft data, let's say, that might well go into a long-term archive to serve the scientific community. So after I finished on Smart One, I started off on Mars Express and Smart One, because Smart One was at that time just starting to take data. And I started off on Mars Express and Smart One as what they call the archive scientist. So this was basically a job where you try and make sure that the format of the data which is coming down from the spacecraft is going to be useful to a scientist, and is formatted in a way which means in years to come, when the scientific PI team, who are directly involved in the instruments, are no longer available, that the data can still be understood. So we have a long-term objective, a long-term archive, let's say. So in 20, 30 years' time, somebody should still be able to come to the Mars Express data archive and understand exactly what they should do with the data in order to produce some scientific output. And that's basically the purpose of the Planetary Science Archive. It's to serve long-term all of the planetary data to the community. So we're not here talking about an active archive where we're providing analytical tools and all sorts of crazy things on top of the archive. It's more about the content and the quality of the content of the archive itself, making sure that people can find the data that they need in order to do a certain scientific analysis. And after I spent a few years as the Mars Express and Smart One archive scientist, I took over in a coordination role to try and lead the archive for Rosetta, for the future missions of BepiColombo. Venus Express at that time was just starting to take data as well. And that's when you came in as well. And at that time, it was more about trying to coordinate the archive scientist team and making sure that they are communicating correctly with the PI teams, communicating correctly with our NASA colleagues who are also archiving some of the data, so as we could globally serve this data. So, I mean, the drive is, of course, to make sure that the European science community have access to good science data. But we want to also be able to serve the communities in America, in Japan, in India, in Russia, so all around the world. And we have something called the International Planetary Data Alliance, which started to take shape around about that time. And this is basically a collection of all of the major planetary archiving authorities around the world. So NASA, ESA, PSA, DLR from Germany, the UK Space Agency, CNES from France, ISRO from India, Roscosmos from Russia, all of these, the Chinese Space Agency, they all have representatives within this alliance. And the objective here is that we try and open as much as possible the scientific data to the world. We're still a long way from being able to do that because there are so many political barriers that have to be broken down to share all of this data. But at least between ESA and NASA, those boundaries are very, very low now. So it's much easier for us to find NASA data within the PSA and for the PDS to be able to come back and look through all of our archives for our Venus Express data, our Mars Express data. So in my PSA coordinator role, there was an awful lot of work in not just populating the archives with our own data, but in making sure that everything would be globally accessible and globally understandable. So we're using standards which are understood across the world by planetary scientists to make sure that the metadata, the information which describes the data within the archive, is universally understood, is correct, first of all, and is universally understood and scientifically useful. And this is on a global scale now. This has been adopted on a global scale, and we're trying to make sure that all of the future missions that we are flying will follow the same standards to make sure that, as I say, everything is scientifically useful, but also everything is attainable from any archive. So you should be able to come to the ESA archive and find data from Japan. This is what we're working on for BepiColombo, for example. BepiColombo has two components. It has a planetary orbiter, which is managed by ESA, and it has a magnetospheric orbiter, which is driven by JAXA, by Japan. And the data for the magnetospheric orbiter will be stored in Japan, and the data from the planetary orbiter will be stored here at ESA. And we need to make sure that there is complete transparency between those two data stores. So people coming into Japan and people coming in from ESA will simply see BepiColombo data. They'll be able to see it without any idea where it's stored. They don't need to know whether it's stored in Holland, in Spain, in Japan, in India. It shouldn't matter. They should simply be able to come into an archive and say, show me what data you've got for BepiColombo. And on a global scale, we should then be able to find any data from BepiColombo within any of the archiving authorities, holdings, and serve that back to the user. So that's what we're aiming for in the long term.
There's a final question. I just want to ask you, if there's anybody listening to this who's intrigued by anything you've said, do you have any words of advice or any tips from your own experience about how they can get into doing work like you've been doing, either in archiving or earlier on in working in space missions, doing extraterrestrial geology, this kind of thing?
Well, like I said, for me, it was very serendipitous. I was extremely lucky. And I've heard this from a lot of people who work here. A lot of people say, oh, I was really lucky. I landed on my feet. I met the right person at the right time. I never intended to do this originally, but somehow the door was opened. And I think it all comes from following your dreams to a certain extent, and talking to various people. Just, you need to go out there, you need to communicate, you need to try and not sell yourself to people so much, but just listen to what people have to say. Try and learn these things. I never expected to get into data archiving at all. It was whilst I was working on Smart One, where I heard that somebody in an office 3 or 4 doors away from me was starting to build a planetary science archive for a future mission for Mars Express. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. So I had lunch with this person, and we had a little chat, and it turned out that Smart One would be a very useful testing case for this future archive, and that opened the door for the next 10 years of my career, just through talking to somebody, because I thought this sounded quite interesting. The same with my degree. I bumped into the guy in the corridor and I thought, I've always been interested in astronomy. I had a passion for it when I was a young child. So let's have a chat with this person. And he convinced me to at least try for something else. You've got to sort of be brave. Try things out, talk to different people, and doors will open and you will land on your feet. If you're passionate enough and you talk to enough people, then you will almost certainly find a way. And that's basically what I did. I fell on my feet. But I fell on my feet partly because I was nudging those doors open myself by talking to people. And that's the only thing that I would advise. Talk to people. There are plenty of people here. The phones are always there, available for people. I'm always happy to talk to anybody. I have lots of people who phone up every now and again and ask for advice on how they can get into ESA or who they need to talk to. And if I don't hear from them, then I don't know that they're looking. So I can't help them. And it's exactly that. You just try and talk to as many people as possible, open as many doors as possible, and eventually one of them will stay open long enough for you to step through. And that's all I would recommend. That's exactly what I did.
Fantastic advice. So thank you very much, Dr. David Heather, for taking time to speak to Western Worlds. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks very much.
The pleasure's been all mine. Thank you.
And now for the roundtable discussion.
Well, that was a really interesting interview with Dave Heather. Well, what did you guys think about the interview?
Let's first talk about how he got into astronomy.
Yeah.
I loved how it was just he was going to do chemistry, and then he ran into this prof who convinced him in a couple of hours that he should take astronomy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the awesomeness of astronomy. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I really enjoyed his, you know, learning about his career path and how he got to where he's today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, astronomy is very, it's a big topic that I think anyone that even tips their toes into it is like immediately engaged in it and wants to continue learning because there is so much to learn. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit of the same experience for me, just being in engineering and then wanting to do the physics as well. And then as I kind of explored physics, I kind of got into the astrophysics side and the astronomy. And that's really what engaged me is the astronomy side, more so than the physics side.
Mm. So, like, what did you think about his current experience, the way he was able to leverage, you know, his interest in geology into planetary science and then move on to doing the, you know, archive development, which, of course, you know, for any scientists, I'm sure any scientist that has done any work with, you know, satellite-based data will recognize the importance of good archiving. What did you guys think about that, the sort of his experience there?
I think it was pretty cool because it's kind of, we are in an era for big data science, right? So we are collecting way more information that we can process. So, and, you know, again, looking at the same data with different eyes, you have different perspective. With newer technology, you can come up with new things that could be, you know, seen in the data that was collected maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago, but didn't have the technology at that time to kind of process it. But then you were able to do that with newer versions of computer softwares, newer telescope technology, etc. So, you know, it's pretty interesting that he obviously has the background in astronomy and geology, so understands kind of why these things are taken and how and why they're doing it,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of, you know, using that background to basically compress this data to be useful for scientists to, you know, basically do whatever science they want with
it. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I also thought it was really interesting how he got pulled into the Smart One mission, how it was a mission based on like technology instead of like based on the science goals, and so he was brought in to make sure that the science was actually useful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of an opposite perspective on how most missions would be designed.
Yeah, exactly. So, a lot of missions are designed with science goals coming first, and then engineering those becomes a sort of much after kind of situation.
Yeah, to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But,
yeah. I want a big telescope. Well, what do you want to do with that telescope?
Yeah, exactly.
This is all the science I want to do. Well, who's going to build the big telescope? Someone will.
Yeah, right, exactly so. Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's quite interesting hearing about that. I always found Dave's story to be very, a very inspiring story. Like, his background was, you know, equal parts, you know, luck and determination and technical interest and also realism, you know. He states during the interview at one point that he never thought that he could get into these kinds of fields because he wasn't very strong in mathematics, but then he realized he can combine his interest in geology and do, you know, comparative planetology. So it's like another example of how you can bring your interest and the knowledge you pick up in, you know, whatever your particular interest is, into this kind of area, into the sort of space area. And there's room for a lot of different things here, which is very, very interesting.
Yeah, you don't need to be a math expert or a physics expert if you want to work in space. Like, there's a lot of ways you can do that.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by John Kissy and Parshti Patel and featured an interview by co-host John Kissy. Our roundtable discussion featured John Kissy, Parshti Patel, and Dana Beaton. And our editors were John Kissy and Dana Beaton. And I am John Kissy. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online, listen to past episodes, and learn more about Western Worlds by going to our website at www.uwo.ca/westernworlds. We are available on Twitter, Facebook, Internet Archive, and SoundCloud. On behalf of everybody at Western Worlds, I would like to thank you for joining us. We'll hope you'll be able to join us again next time here on Western Worlds.